This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Today we chant the Heart Sutra. We chant it now once in Japanese, the Makahanya, and one time in English in the morning, and one time in English in the evening. And we chant it in Germany, we do it three times. We do it one time in Japanese, one time in English, so that our teacher knows what we are chanting, and he trusts the Germans with the translation. And we also chant it in German, and it sounds a little bit too much like Catholic Church for me in German. But it's okay, it's really okay also to know what are we chanting. So the Mahanya starts Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the Prajna Paramita, perceived that all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. And this is one sentence, and that's a kind of all what we need, because this teaching is a lot about the Four Noble Truths, how to end suffering. And it gives us a recipe already at the very beginning, in the first sentence of the Heart Sutra, what to do, and so that we can end suffering. So the question is, what I'm always interested in, how can I practice with such a sentence? It's just one sentence out of a sutra. And to practice with this is kind of, how do I find the handle to lift it up and to look at it? What can I do with sutra so that I get an access to this wisdom teaching? And no question, it contains the wisdom teaching, basic wisdom teaching of Buddhism. How do I get an access? How do I get this sutra into my body? I mean, I can try to get it into my head and I can think back and forth, but this works just to a certain degree. The question is also, how do I get it into my practice? What do I do with that? And one thing what we do with the sutras, we chant them. And so let me talk a little bit about the chanting and about the service. When we sit a 40-minute period, what we do in the morning and also in the evening, shortly before the period ends, 2-3 minutes, the Doan gets up and prepares the altar, the incense for the service. And then the Doan goes back and rings the small bell, and that's the signal this the Zazen is over. That's it. And the question is already, can you let the bell end your Zazen? Or did you end your Zazen quite a while ago, and are you just waiting for the Doan to end the Zazen? That's already the difference, yeah. And feel this difference. Sometimes you get this bell into your inner silence, and then the bell sounds quite nice, and this, oh, that's the bell, the Zazen is over. And sometimes I wait for it, yeah, for sure, everyone is doing that too. This is why I don't like one of our Doans, he started to use this electronic beep watch, and there's first a beep and then now we will hear the bell. And this kind of beep takes this sound of the bell away, because it's not this surprise, oh, that's the bell. You know now I will hear the bell pretty soon. Okay, then we get ready for the service, and because there are so many people here now, and also being at this service, Let's change that a little bit. We use the sabotos in the morning, because in the morning we sit down during the service. We go down in a chashu. But you also can take a sabaton in the evening. It makes it much easier for you to bow on. It's not that hard. It's easier for the knees when you take one of the sabatons. And let's line them up so that they are lined up with my bowing mat in the middle. And then for the bowing, we face the altar. So we are all standing like this, behind your bowing mat, and we face the altar. And then you have your sutra card already ready, so that there's no running around and looking for the sutra cards when the Doa announces the chant. Everyone should have, who wants a sutra card already on the sabaton. And then we do the three bows in the evening, 9 in the morning. And then, after these first three bows, I go back to the altar, I do another incense offering, and then the big bell starts with my bow. It's a hit on the big bell. And at one point you will hear this ding ding, 2 hits on the small bell. And that's the signal for everyone to turn around so that you can stand on the sabaton in the evening when you don't sit down, and of course you sit down on the sabaton in the morning, but for the chanting we all face each other. That's the idea of it. For the bowing we face the altar, somehow the altar. But for the chanting we turn around and we face each other. Because for the chanting it's important that we also hear each other. Because that's the thing about the chant. It's to find your own voice in the chant, to give energy in that, and to feel your voice like it is different in the morning chant or in the evening, or when you are tired or exhausted or when you have a lot of energy. This always changes your voice, and feel that. But it's also, chanting is also to kind of get a feeling for the voice, for the group voice, for everyone chanting together. Suzuki Roshi, he used to say, chant with your ears. This means always also listen to the other voices, yeah. And sometimes we get one voice and you hear one voice. And sometimes everyone, including myself, is just chanting with his or her own voice, and there's a kind of mass up mixed chanting going on. That's okay too. We need both to kind of make our experience. But this chanting is a door, a step to get a sutra into your body. That's an access to a sutra without knowing what we are chanting. That's why I like these Japanese chants so much. We don't know what we chant. Especially I want to change the evening chant a little bit and start with the Daihi Shindarani. This is just the Japanese chant. It's almost impossible to translate. So kind of no one knows how to translate that. But it's great to chant that, because it's a way to get the chant, to get this wisdom teaching into your body. And I kind of found my voice through the chanting in Buddhism. Yeah. I always thought that I cannot sing. And this was when I went to the gymnasium. Maybe I was 8, 9 years old, and this was a gymnasium just for boys, and they looked for boys with a good voice for the chorus. And to be on the chorus, this was a thing to do. I remember one time the boys in the chorus, they went to Paris to chant somewhere there in the cathedral. So they have been looking for good voices, so we have been all lined up and we had to sing. I don't know what we had to sing as little boys. And the leader of the chorus, he went around and tried to kind of listen to each voice to figure out, oh yes, I want this boy in the chorus, yeah. And he couldn't hear me. So he came closer with his ear, and the closer this fleshy, hairy ear came to my mouth, the more my voice disappeared. And this was basically the end of my singing career. He decided, well, he cannot sing. And I thought, well, I cannot sing, and there was no support in our family to sing, nothing like this. So I thought, well, I cannot sing, yeah. And the more I thought I cannot sing, the more this was true, yeah. And I had one experience, a boyfriend of mine, I had a Thai boyfriend, and we lived together in Thailand for a while. And Thais love to sing, and they love to go to karaoke. Like Japanese folks, they, all the Asian people, they kind of love karaoke, yeah. So we had been in Bangkok in a karaoke bar, and he was singing his Thai songs up and down, and he liked the Mariah Carey song. She has one famous one. You know the whole text, he even didn't have to look at the text that is always shown there on the screen. And then finally they want me to sing, yeah. And I needed quite a lot of beer to get my energy together, to even take a look at this book with the English song, with the English songs. So I went for Bruce Springsteen, I'm on Fire. Yeah. and did actually pretty well. Yeah. But the voice and this feeling the voice in the body and getting a feeling for your voice, this is what I developed through chanting. This is why chanting is so important. I found I got the new wind bell yesterday, and Suzuki Roshi was asked in a cool Q&A. Someone asked me on the phone, do you have always a Q&A after lecture? I said, we have what? Americans are so used to that, and I just don't know that. So someone in a Q&A, someone asked Suzuki Roshi, I wonder about the philosophy and the sutras and the chanting, the religion of Buddhism, why that seemed to be necessary. I explained it this way. This is Suzuki Roshi's answer. Chanting will make your practice deeper, and the feeling of chanting or scripture makes your practice more pure. In this way, over and over, we will have a deeper practice. In this sense, chanting is necessary. In China, some great Zen master would write a beautiful poem about their state of mind or understanding or the teaching, and people would chant it while walking. In Japan, we still do it. In the Buddha hall, with scriptures in our hands, we chant the sutra. That is very helpful. So this is what we do. That's very helpful to understand the sutra without understanding it. That is what I like about that. It's an access to a sutra without kind of knowing what we are chanting here. So this is one handle to understand the sutra, yeah. And then it says at the beginning, Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, yeah. So here we have now the second access to open the sutra or to understand the sutra. It says, practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, this is the wisdom practice, yeah, or this wisdom steps of practice. And how can we do that? How can we practice deeply and use our practice for an understanding of the sutra? Well, what we do is we have to sit down, we have to sit still, we have to find this silence. We have to find this being uplifted, to have a straight back, we get a feeling for being uplifted with a straight back. And we have to be, this is one way of practicing deeply, with our breath, without changing as much as possible, not changing this natural rhythm of the breath. So let your body breathe and just watch it, without changing, without forcing it to a break or to a long inhale and short exhale or something like this. Just let your body doing the breathing and watch it. That's practicing deeply. Yeah? And that's again access to the sutra. This is what it says right away in the first sentences. Avalokiteshvara, he practiced deeply. And then he figured that. And it's very important when we look at sutras or at any Buddhist text, when we ask ourselves, well, where do these texts come from? Who developed these texts? What is the story of a sutra? And we can go back to Buddha. He first of all, he sat down and practiced, first of all with different teachers and then by himself under this Bodhi tree. And this is what he did. He practiced deeply the Prajna Paramita. And out of this practice he found the realization. And then first he thought, I cannot teach that, there's no way to teach that. But more and more people have been interested and forced him, tell us what to do. So he started teaching. And no one ever wrote something down. There was nothing like this. They just listened to him, they lived with him, and they practiced with him. And after Buddha passed away, they thought, oh, it would be too bad if we kind of forget all what the Buddha said. His disciples, Ananda, Rahula, his son, and whoever was there. So they had a first meeting, a kind of first practice meeting, and they started to write down what they remembered, what the Buddha said. And there was Ananda, he remembered everything. He kind of seemed to have a brain like a 10 gigabyte hard disk or something like this. He remembered everything. So this is how the first teaching has been written down. But you have to look at a sutra in that way. First, there is the breath. First, there is this practice to sit down, to sit still. And out of finding your realization or making your experience in that, the sutra arise. Because people found their realization, Buddha found his Buddha nature in that. Our ancestors, they found their Buddha nature in this practice. And out of their Buddha nature, they sat down and said, well, how can I put that in words? It's almost impossible. And this is how the koans arise, how sutra arise, and all that. But first of all, there was the practice. When we look to the Western philosophy, or to the Greek philosophy, Socrates, Plato, Schopenhauer, and Hegel and Nietzsche and all these guys, for sure they all have been really smart guys and they have brilliant ideas about what life is all about, who am I. They all ask these questions. These are also Buddhist questions. So the questions they ask are pretty much the same. But they sat down right away and they start to think about that. And out of their thinking, they developed this Western philosophy. This, for sure, brilliant, brilliant ideas, great to read, sometimes difficult to understand, but for sure, very smart. but no one was there to tell them, well, try that. First of all, sit down, sit still, breathe, watch your breath. Try not to think or try to step away from your thinking and let that establish in your body, and then out of this realization you can think about your life and who you are. And for sure this would have changed the Western philosophy completely. But they started right away with the thinking. That's the difference. And it's also a difference for us, because it's difficult to go to look at a sutra just with the thinking mind, just think about what does that mean. But you can use this other access, you can use your breath to understand, you can use the chant to understand. And that's also a different way of understanding. It is an understanding without understanding by thinking about that. And that's totally different. And it also will change you have to change your attitude for your body, because when you get that first of all you have to practice, and out of this practice you get the understanding, well, you have to trust your practice and you have to trust your body. And you have to trust your body that an understanding is coming out of your body, out of your practice. You cannot trust someone else's practice or someone else's body. First of all, you have to trust your own body. And this is also what the sutra teaches, is teaching us. Well, trust your own body, trust your practice, because that's the only practice you can trust. And when you sit down and you have the feeling, well, today I'm sitting very well and I can be with my breath and this is working very well. Oh, wow, there's the bell already. I thought I could sit for 10 more minutes. Trust that. And sometimes you sit down and it's itching all over and you want to move and you think, well, that's like a crooked cucumber, I'm hanging around on this safu. Well, you also have to trust that, because this is also your practice. Yeah, both. And accept both and say, okay, this was today I have been a crooked cucumber Buddha, and tomorrow I will be a little bit perfect Buddha, more perfect Buddha on my cushion. This is what the sutra is teaching, is trust that. Yeah. And then, of course, it's also interesting to look finally, yeah, what does the sutra say? What is the teaching in that? Or what is the third teaching? There is the chanting as a teaching, there is the practice as a teaching or as an access. And of course we also can try to understand what the sutra says. And it says, when practicing deeply the Prajna Paramita, perceived that all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. So here another teaching comes in, the teaching of the five skandhas. And it's a little bit too late to start with the five skandha teaching. Maybe I do this in the next talk. But let me very briefly give you an idea in a very simple way what the five skandhas are. It's nothing else than a kind of Buddhist recipe. I mean, the five skandhas, we chant that in the following, it's form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness. It's nothing else than a Buddhist recipe. It's a Buddhist recipe to reorder your life, or whatever belongs to your life. When we talk about our life, that's me, that's you, that's inside, that's outside, that's the house, that's the sound, that's the sun outside, kind of we have these We have this idea, that's our life. That's my world. That's the world outside, that's my world inside. And the five skandhas, all they want to do is, they say, okay, they don't add anything to your world, they don't take anything away, but they ask you to put all that into a little bit of different order, like buying a new bookshelf, and then the five skandhas says, okay, now these will be the novels, this is the form, these will be the feelings, that's the consciousness, that's the thinking, and so on. So it's just reorder your life, your world. That's practicing with the five skandhas. It's nothing else than a recipe. Okay, and when Avalokiteshvara, he was practicing with the five skandhas, and he figured that all five skandhas are free of an own being. And that means nothing else, like there is no self. This is what he figured. And here we have, in one sentence, the kind of the biggest chunk of the Buddhist teaching. There is no self. And when you realize that, you are free from suffering. So that's basically, when we want to understand Buddhism, all what we need. We have to realize that there is no self, and then the problems are gone, then there is no suffering. But that's not so easy to do. Because here we have a wisdom teaching kind of, no one agrees. Who agrees that there is no self? Who says, yes, there's no self? I mean, you can look, for example, at Buddhist teaching, like everything is impermanent. That's the Buddhist teaching. And we get an access to that everything is impermanent by thinking about that. You can say, yes, of course, my life is impermanent. It might be the whole planet might be implode or whatever is going on. But finally, I think everyone will agree that everything is impermanent. So we find an access to that through our thinking. Of course, we have to get it into our realization, because no one is living that in a way through life that everything is impermanent. We try to kind of hold on to things. But from the thinking we understand everything is impermanent. That there is no self, this is not understandable through thinking. How do you want to think? You can, when you say, well, I agree there is no self, that's already not possible, because there is no one who can agree. So what to do? We have here the biggest chunk. When we understand that and we get that, that's all we have to know about Buddhism. And one way to understand that, that's the teaching of the five skandhas. To get this feeling, for example, like go to sound, go to a bird singing in the garden, and get this feeling, well, there is just sound. This is one skandha, the perception. There is just sound. When you are sitting, we need to sit still. Again, we need this practice to experience that. It doesn't work, or it's very, very difficult without this practice. But then you are sitting here, and you say, oh, there's just sound. There's just the bell. And when you practice that, can you practice that there is even no one to hear the bell? There's just the bell. There's just the bird singing. There's no one who could say, well, I hear the bird, or I hear the bell, and that's it. The Sazen is over. No, there's just sound. And that's the access over the five skandhas to that there is no self. Just hearing, just seeing. That's one of the five skandhas, that's perception. Or there's just form, there's just the body. Just body. No one say, but that's my body, that's your body. There's just body. So this slowly, this really takes time and it's not so easy to practice, but it takes, you get a feeling or you get a taste for that, that to take this self out, or actually that there is no self. And that's the basic Buddhist teaching here. So here already in the first sentence of this beautiful Heart Sutra, we have, it covers everything. That's basically all what we need. That's all about the practice, what we need. It covers the whole Buddhist teaching in one sentence. Okay, do you have questions about that? Comments? Everything is clear? Is there still someone there to understand, or is there no one to understand? Yeah, Lynn?
Something that I thought is that to realize that there's no self without the framework of Buddhism is a terrible crisis. I mean, because if you take a Western framework to that and realize there's no self, you have the whole, you know, existential, unexplained, terrible thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's having a different framework is what makes it, you know, bearable.
I mean, when you look at our society, what makes this world go round, what makes the society going on, that is basically this strong sense of a self. Mm-hmm. This is what keeps us busy all the time. And here is Buddhism and say, well, that's an illusion. You're just chasing illusion. You're following dreams. This is about the self. There is no self. And Buddhism, they are so sure about that. At the end of the sutra, it says, well, that's true. That's not false. That's true. So someone, they experience that. They don't say that out of a fantastic philosophical idea, they realize that, and out of this realization they can say, well, listen, that's true, there is no self. But this is so hard to understand because our society is always turning around a kind of self. Who am I? What am I? And so on. This keeps the business going. This keeps the business going, that there is this idea of a self. This is what we all chase for. And Buddhism said, well, listen, that's an illusion. There's no self. But here they have this huge gap. This is the wisdom teaching, and this is what we understand, what we realize, what we live in. And how do we get that kind of connected, or how do we get a taste of that?
I guess it's spiritually speaking, because like I was thinking, like in communist countries, where they try to cut that sense of self, to manipulate and to control you.
Well, they cut one sense of self and they produce another one. Yeah, I mean they had their sense of self of whatever thought the communist they are, what they want to be, and they just took one sense of self away and said, this is not what we follow, this is the ideal sense of self, this is what we should follow, and they just replaced it to another one. But that's too bad. Buddhism would have developed for sure in another way when they had figured out and when they realized that there is no self. I'm sure they didn't need any walls around communist countries, you know. Mm-hmm. And they don't need any army when they realize that there is no self.
Mm. Do you think that if practitioners only chanted the Japanese version of the Heart Sutra and not the English version as well, that would be as powerful a teacher? I'll just make an aside and tell you a little bit about my an ancient form of Japanese that is in the sutras, they wouldn't have a cognitive understanding.
Yes, they had. But reading, for example, wasn't allowed in the Japanese monastery. They had to read on the toilet. Now, there's a little candle and matches or whatever they use. For a long time, for the beginner student, reading was just not allowed. They had to practice. And they didn't give them any food for the thinking. They took all that away. Practice, chant, and they forced them, really, with the Kyosako, to go into find this voice of chanting. They forced them into this body practice as an access to a sutra, much more than into the intellectual understanding. But as Westerners, we want both, and we need both. We need also the food for the thinking. That's good. It's nothing wrong about that. Okay, then, yeah, that's it. Thanks for listening.